This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
Muhammad and Ali Sahib Ismail. All right. So today, inshallah, we'll start the beginning of the text of Abu Shuja' al-Fiqh al-Shafi'i. This is going to be, inshallah, a series of courses that are going to go through preliminary or introductory texts in the different madhahib of fiqh. Meaning, we will start with al-madhahib al-Shafi'i. We'll go through an introductory text in that, and then we will move to the other three madhahib, doing an introductory text in each and every one of them. Now, the first one will always take the longest time because it's going to will take some time going to some detail. So maybe I should put it over here. All right. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And then when we do an introductory text in the second and third and fourth madhhab, it'll be much quicker because we've already covered everything that in the first time around. We're just going to look at the differences between. Now, what do we get from doing this? First of all, when you understand a text in one of the four major or known madhhab of Islamic thought, what you know now is how to practice Islamic rituals and how to understand Islamic law based on the opinion of a very large group of scholars. Meaning a large group of scholars came together and agreed that this is how they believe is the best way to practice Islam. That's what they think is the best way. It is not the only way, but in their understanding, in their opinion, this is the best way. Based on all the evidence that they looked at, based on the years of study that they spent, they looked at all of it and they came to the conclusion that this is the best way to do it for them. So when we say that this is Madhhab al-Shafi'i, what it actually means is that a number of scholars, around 600 scholars, if you want to talk about the first maybe 400 years, came together, studied Islamic law, they studied the Quran, they studied linguistics, they looked at hadith, they studied all the different Islamic sciences and came up with the conclusion that this is their best interpretation of all of that. This is how they see to be the best way. Now this is not the only way, but it is a way that you could easily and comfortably say that scholars who have studied the text believe to be a proper interpretation. So you can practice a madhab, and you can take a madhab and practice it with a lot of comfort and safety, knowing that this is one of the proper ways of practicing because scholars have looked at the evidence and this is their conclusions or the conclusion that they drew. The same thing if we study the Hanafi madhab or the Maliki or the Hanbali, it's the same concept here. Now, why do they interpret things differently? We'll talk about that, inshallah, slowly as we go through. I'll give you some examples, but to be honest, that is not the focus of studying fiqh. Meaning, the focus of studying fiqh is not for me to explain to you why it is that they differed, but I'll show you how they differed, and then you'll kind of draw the conclusions of why on your own. You'll see, oh, this could be understood in more than one way, and that's why he chose to understand it like this, and the other scholars chose to understand it in a bit of a different manner. Now, what do you get from studying a preliminary or introductory text in any madhab? Shafi'i is going to be the one we start with, but what do you get from that? You now know, if you'd study this introductory text, you now know how to practice all the rituals and all the basic issues of Islamic law and Islamic practice and faith in a structured manner. You know how to do it in a structured way based on the consensus opinion of many scholars that belong to one school of thought. You don't have the ability to answer questions regarding is this okay to do or is this not okay to do. You don't know how to say that yet. You don't even know the different opinions of the same madhab, because when you look at one school of thought, like the Shafi'i school of thought, there are multiple opinions sometimes within the school of thought. What an introductory text gives you, what it gives you is the prominent opinion within the madhab. So you don't know all the opinions of one madhab, you don't know the opinions of the other madhab either. So you don't have the ability to answer questions regarding, is it okay for me during prayer to do this or that? You don't know how to do that. But what you can do is, I don't know if it's okay or not, but I'll tell you what I do know. I know that as far as the madhhab al-Shafi'i is concerned, we do this. And then you can show him something that is 100% proper. It's okay to do it that way. But what he is doing may be correct as well. You don't know yet, right? You don't have the ability to come up to someone who is doing something in salah that's not what you do, or is practicing something in zakah, or in siyam, or in hajj, or in his daily rituals, and say that is not correct because I learned from this text that this is the right way to do it. No, you have the ability to practice something with a level of security and safety and comfortability that this is proper. I'm doing it in a way that many scholars have approved of and are okay with. But you can't go and correct people. Now you may say, well, that's no fun. Well, if you're here because that's what you want, then you're in the wrong place. That's not what we're going to teach you. Not how to go and correct people or give nasiha, rather how to do things properly, based on the prominent opinion of a very large number of scholars. Now, once we finish studying one introductory text, and then we study another one in another madhab, and we study four, then you still don't have the ability to tell someone you're doing something wrong, but now you have a wider spectrum. Now you can say, okay, brother, when it comes to praying or doing this act, these are the different opinions, the prominent opinions of the madhab that I can offer you. This is what I know, they can do this and this and this. You still don't have the ability to tell him what he's doing is wrong, right? And you still don't have the ability to go and fix what he's doing, unless, of course, it's something that is clearly a mistake that we will, inshallah, look into stuff like that as we go along. But you'll just have a broader understanding, meaning you'll have more than one choice. You can say the Hanafis say this, the Shafi'i say this, and maybe the Malik and Hanabila say something different. So there's three different opinions regarding an idea. So there's four different major schools of thought in Sunni Islamic madhahib or faith, meaning in the Sunni Islamic school of thought, there are four basic schools that have been studied for many, many years, and the scholars of these madhahib have spent a significant amount of time and effort in studying all the different types of evidence that exist, and then taking that evidence, processing it, and trying to come up with a way of interpreting it properly and in a way that is synchronized and harmonic.
So do you get to choose which one you want?
Yeah, so when it comes to what are we okay to do? Like, is it okay for us to just choose an opinion from each madhab and live like that? Most scholars are okay with that way of life. Meaning, if you tatabba'at al-rukhas, if you just followed rukhas, or if you just took an opinion from this madhab, an opinion from this madhab, most scholars are okay with this, as long as you don't destroy the structure of the action itself. So you don't take opinions that are so different from each other that you end up the action not having a skeleton of what it actually was to begin with. But that's very rare, and we don't really have many examples of that. So most scholars are okay with you taking different opinions from different madhab, but it's always good if you're starting out learning Islamic law and trying to understand a bit of jurisprudence in Islam, for you to study one madhab first. Just understand one, understand how it's practiced, practice it, and then you can study others, because sometimes you're going to find that the madhab Shafi'i works for you awesome, like you, and then you'll find things like, we'll even come across a few things today, like that's going to be significant, that's going to be very difficult for me to continue, and I'll talk, and when something like that comes up, I will talk about comparative fiqh, and I'll bring up some different interpretations of evidence, inshallah. But it's, yes.
What age is it recommended to pick your school of thought?
So you don't pick a school of thought. See, that's an important thing. There's no preference here. None of the schools of thought are 100% right or 100% wrong. They all have certain different degrees of right and wrong within them, because it's human interpretation of holy text. There's always going to be different ways of looking at things. What I want you to do is to be familiar with these different interpretations, and then you can choose what makes more sense to you, and then you can choose what you feel serves the spirit of the deen more than anything else.
Do Sunnis and Shias have different schools of thought?
So Shia have a significantly different way of looking at things, meaning from the origins of where they take their evidence, meaning what makes Sunnis as one school of thought is that the origin or the source of evidence is the same for all of them. So Imam Abu Hanifa, Imam Malik, Imam Shafi, Imam Ahmed all took evidence from the same sources. Shia have different sources. They use other things. That's why there's significant differences in the way that we think. Of course, we'll start with studying the four basic madhab, and then maybe we'll have a quick review of Ibadi, Khawarij, Shia, and other schools of kind of how they look at things. But that is basically why we're studying this. So what I'm offering you is a proper way to practice things that follows a systematic, structured manner, meaning it has a way of thought that is clear, that is well described. It is not the only way of thought. I'm not even claiming it's the best way of thought, but it is one way that is based on years and years and years of scholars accumulating evidence and interpreting it and understanding it. Now, inshallah, you build enough Islamic knowledge from the Quran and Sunnah and Arabic so that you can do that on your own, and that'll be fine. Then you can look at the dalil, look at the evidence itself, think about it, and then say, this is what I think is the right way based on my understanding of it. But until then, it's nice to take what scholars have already done before you. And then if you take different opinions, what you end up with is a very rich culture. And you stop. See, what happens when you study more than one madhab is that you calm down a bit. You stop cringing every time you see someone doing something that's not the way you were told. See, a lot of people I can see, like they physically cringe when they see something that's not what they're taught. It's important for me that doesn't happen to you based on what I teach here. This is an introductory text. You're taking something very simple. It doesn't give you the wide spectrum of things. You're getting a very limited view of how jurisprudence works. But if we, inshallah, within a year and a half of studying, this will take around 5 to 6 months of studying this text, and then 2 to 3 months for each text after that. After a year and a half, you will have studied a introductory text in all form of the. And that way you have a much broader way of understanding things. And you will find that, it's okay to do more than one thing in prayer. It's okay to go like this, like this, like this. It's all fine. There's all evidence to support all of it. So do whatever you want as long as, you know. And then you'll understand what is it that they didn't differ upon. Like the things that the scholars did not differ upon, suddenly will become the things that are very important to you. None of the scholars differed on khushu' and salah and hudur and focus. None of them differed on that. None of them differed on the importance of that at all. They differed on other things. They discussed many things of moving the finger, and we'll go through during prayer and how to do tartib of wudu, and they differed on all these things, but they didn't differ on the basic concept of hygiene being the result of wudu. So if you come after wudu and you still stink and everything is dirty, then it didn't serve the purpose, so it didn't work out. They differed on certain things, and they didn't differ on others. The things that what you learn from studying the madhahib is the stuff that they did differ upon, and then you relax, because these things are just trivial issues that are not that big a deal. And then the other things that they didn't differ upon become much more important to you. And you understand that these are the fundamental principles, these are the basics, the maxims that I have to hold on to. And then your prioritizing in Islam will become much better, much healthier. You'll be able to prioritize better, inshallah. Yes.
There may be things they differed on, but if there's a clear hadith that says, that's it, and one school says, no, it doesn't matter, my opinion, I wouldn't go with that. Yeah. I wouldn't use that if you're looking for a fatwa to go with that.
So what you end up learning from this is that there is no school of thought that just says that hadith, I just don't care about it. No, there's always rationale, because a school of thought is not the opinion of one dude. It's the opinion of many, many scholars who recited that hadith, memorized it, probably hold it in high regards, but have a different interpretation of it. So what you learn from fiqh is to understand that there's always different ways sometimes to understand the thing that may seem to you unidimensional. I mean, you may look at something, there's only one dimension to this, and then a scholar would say, no, this is multidimensional. There's more than one way to look at this hadith and understand it and interpret it in the light of other ahadith and other texts, holy texts that exist. So that's what this whole thing is hopefully going to help you with. Because it becomes very difficult if you don't have the ability to understand that there's a difference, there's a big difference between text and interpretation of text. There's a big difference between certain text from an authenticity point of view, and from a descriptive point of view, and then probable text from an authenticity point of view, and from a descriptive point of view, meaning not everything is equal when it comes to dealing with evidence, and that's why the schools of thought have different approaches to how they look at this evidence. And it just gives it's very rich, and it offers you a lot of many things to think about. I'm happy that when we voted out the madhab, we just start with the madhab al-Shafi'i, because it's quite balanced in regards to how people view it in comparison to the other madhab. Again, there is no better madhab, really. There isn't. They're all yani wallahu alam, as equal as can be. They all serve the same purpose. They just look at things differently. And once you get that chance to look at and see how they see different things differently, understand how they ended up comprehending and interpreting things differently, you build a very nice foundation, and you have a very broad range and broad way of understanding things, which is what I hope, inshallah, to help them. Now, I did put together packages. I have, I think, 11 packages over here. For those who had put on that they were going to attend physically or virtually, they can pick one up. Those who still want to attend and didn't get one, I'll just take numbers today, and then I'll prepare, inshallah, more copies. Now, what's in it is a notebook, a pen, and the text in Arabic. Now, the text in Arabic, I don't have. The translation exists online, or doesn't exist online. It's a book. So this is Mukhtasar Abi Shuja', and we'll talk about, inshallah, what it is. And it's this is the whole thing. It's double-sided. The masjid took care of the cost of this. If you want an interpretation of it, an English or English translation of it, there's one written by Musa Ferber. It's the only one that I know of. I've read it. I've read the translation. It looks good. The way that it's translated is fair to me. I think it's fine. But you'd have to buy the book either online online or buy it from a bookstore, because it doesn't really exist as a virtual copy. And if there is a virtual copy, it's bootlegged. So I don't think the author had authorized any of the any of the copies you'll find online. So if that's something you want, I will, however, explain explain the text as we go through it, inshallah, word for word. I have a couple of people who would. You want to stand up? Maybe take these around and see whoever. Just give them put online that they wanted to attend. They can have one, and then those who didn't. I will make some available, inshallah, for you after. These are all Arabic. So the English, you'd have to pick up. You're gonna have to go buy the text from a bookstore, inshallah. Yeah.
Can you post the name of the?
I did. It's all on the Facebook group. I put everything there. I put how much it costs and where you can buy it from. So you can do that, inshallah. I'm going to use at least. Now, you're not required to memorize. The text, in order to be certified in a text. Now the way that studying texts in Islamic faith works is that you either, if it's shi'r, if it's written as poetry, then you are required to memorize the text and understand it and be able to explain it. If it's not poetry, then just understanding it and being able to explain it suffices, and you don't have to do more than that. So this is not a poetry text. This is just a regular text. So it's not required of anyone to memorize it. You do require, however, to be able to read it in Arabic and to be able to understand what it means and explain it. So that is the goal for studying this text, is that you're going to understand the concepts within it and be able, inshallah, to explain it later on for others who would like to benefit from it. It was written by Abu Shuja' or Abu Tayyib Ahmad ibn al-Husayn al-Asfahani rahimahullah, and this man died somewhere in the after 500 Hijri. We don't know for sure. The reason that there's some ambiguity about his biography is the fact that there's another faqih Shafi'i who goes also by the name of Abu Shuja' al-Abu Tayyib and lives elsewhere. And those who wrote biographies of these people mixed them up because of how close they lived to each other and how close their names were, and some misunderstanding of exactly. So we don't know for sure a lot of things about him, rahimahullah, but he was a qadi, he was a judge, and he was at one point or another an advisor to some of the governors of the land. His text is called Matan al-Ghaya wa al-Taqrib, or the Ultimate Conspectus. And this text is one of the most studied texts in the Islamic library. There's over 30 explanations for it, 30 sharh, 30 explanations for that for the book itself by 30 different people, and there's over 15 explanations of the explanation of this text. So there's 30 people who explained the text, and there's 15 people who took the explanation itself and explained it. So it is the center of a lot of fiqh Shafi'i, like a lot of it, to the point where, it's the number of texts that it's huge, like it's very rare. 20 different poems were written to explain it, to write it. So that's 20 different, it was turned into poetry by 20 different people. So altogether there's around 50 pieces of Islamic work that is just based on this simple text. And it's a very renowned one, it's a very celebrated one, because it's very simple and it kind of covers everything. And all the other madhahib have kind of introductory texts that were written after that took the same approach. So it makes it easy for us to study more than one introductory text in all the different madhahib, because they have the same sequence. They go by the exact same way. So the first kitab in this book, the first chapter, and when I say the word kitab, now we're not going to read the introduction, the muqaddimah, it's simple. Go to the page, I think, 15, if you have one of the texts that we just gave out. I'm going to require someone to sit beside me so I can, because I don't know the thing by heart, so that we can read it, inshallah. You can just sit with, so that we can read the text out loud. And we're going to start from page 15, inshallah, today, and go to page 21. We're going to go about 6 or 7 pages per lesson, inshallah. We'll try to finish, inshallah, at the end of January. Okay. So the first page number 15, Kitab al-Tahara. So the book or the chapter of purity, of purification. And this is referring to ritual purification. So this is not talking about medical or just general hygiene. This is talking about ritual purification specifically. Now, are they aligned? Yes, they are. But you still have to see that ritual purification has its own way of doing things. You can clean yourself in many different ways. Like, there's many different ways for you to purify yourself from filth or from najasa or from any. But there's a way that Allah Subhanahu wa Taala specifically talked about, and that we're going to study, which is going to be wudu and ghusl and issues like that. So Kitab al-Tahara means a chapter of purity or ritual purification. So I do. Okay, so someone can use this actually. This is the book, this is the explanation in English. So those who can't read Arabic can sit over there and can use the, can just look at that inshallah. And then if you want to buy that for yourself to help, then you can do that as well. But that's not mine, that's the Sheikh, so you have to return to the Imam inshallah. All right, so Faslun, Anwa'u al-Miyah wa Aqsam. When you say Fasl means paragraph. So that means it's going to have a title, there's going to be a title after. This is how the book is going to work. So Anwa'u al-Miyah wa Aqsamuha, the types of water and the different categorizations or categories of types of water. So al-miyahu allati yajuzu biha at-tathhir sab'u miyah, the different types of water that we're allowed to purify ourselves by. So this is again, remind yourself of the following. This was written in the 5th or 6th Islamic century, or end of the 5th Islamic century. So that is around 900 years ago. So if it's around 900 years ago, then you're talking 1100, right, on the Gregorian calendar. Now that's a significantly, that's very, very long ago. Before, at the time, there was no electricity, there were no faucets, there were no taps. The way water was used was the old-fashioned way. There was a well, you would bring out a bucket, that bucket was put into another container, and then you would, you know, take out of the container with a tool, with a smaller cup or a different tool, and then pour it on your head. Now I lived in a part of Syria where that's what they still do today. There's still no showers coming from top. You have to sit down. They give you a big bin of water, and then you have and then you just put it up and put it on your head. So when you have a shower like that, you'll understand that this is very relevant. But is it relevant today? The concepts are. The way that it's put, maybe not as much, because the fact, and of course all of them have the same, yeah, you'll find this is very similar for most of them, because they were all written in a similar time. Now, the hope is that the next generation of Muslims study enough of the Islamic texts that were written, and understand the evidence, understand the different way of looking at things, and they learn how to logically and rationally go through evidence properly, understand that there's always more than one way to look at things, and then they write, and they continue the legacy of fiqh by writing texts that will be a bit more relevant to people who are living in an era where things function a bit differently. And these texts, again, you know, kind of, they go back 900 years at least. So, al-miyahu allati yajuzu biha at-tathhiru sab'u miyah. So the water, the types of water that it's okay to use for ritual purification are seven types of water. Sab'u miyah. Number one, ma'u as-sama. So we're talking about rain, the water that comes from the sky. So we're talking about rain. Wa ma'u al-bahri, and the water of the ocean or the sea. So this is, of course, the difference being water comes from the sky, you know, unless it's acid rain, which you don't want to do purification with that if you're smart. But besides that, it's always going to be water that's drinkable, and it's not going to be salty water. However, the water of the ocean and the bahr, and the sea is salty water. So if you go to the sea, can you make wudu in the bahr? Of course you can make wudu in the bahr, never. That should be something that's very, very, very clear to you. Now what I'm going to do in the commentary is I'm going to offer sometimes pieces of evidence. I mean, I'll explain to you, I'll give you like a hadith or an ayah that explains why it is like that. Now most of this stuff you'll find quite simple, meaning it makes just this is what it is. There's not much that I need to explain more than what the text is actually saying. But then there's evidence behind it, and I'll give you an insight to that evidence. Now that's usually left for a secondary text, but I think it'll just be beneficial so everyone just kind of sees how that all works. Now, وَمَاءُ الْبَحْرِ, and the water of the sea or the ocean, so salty water. وَمَاءُ النَّهْرِ, or نَهْرِ, and that is the water of a river. So a river or a lake. So if you're at Port Stanley or Grand Bend, then you can make wudu in that water, unless they have a sign saying that the bacteria will kill you if you touch it, then in that case you shouldn't. But besides that, you can make wudu in lakes or rivers, because lakes basically come from rivers or generate them. وَمَاءُ الْبِئْرِ, and the water of a well. وَمَاءُ الْعَيْنِ, and the water of a spring. وَمَاءُ الثَّلْجِ, and the water that comes from thawed out snow or snow itself. If you take snow and put it inside, then it turns into water, then you can use that for wudu as well. وَمَاءُ الْبَرَدِ, and then hail. So hail, if it's significant amount and it then turns into water, and that water you can use that for ritual purification. Now, ثُمَّ الْمِيَاهُ عَلَى أَرْبَعَةِ أَقْسَامٍ, and then water is categorized into four categories. There are four categories of water that we're going to look at. Right? So basically water that is used for purification. We're gonna have four different categories we talk about. Now, in Arabic, the first one is called طاهرٌ مُطَهِّرٌ غَيْرُ مَكْرُوهٌ. طاهر means pure. It is in itself pure. مُطَهِّر, capable of purifying. That's what مُطَهِّر means, right? غَيْر مَكْرُوه, and it is not unrecommended. Now I know that's a double negative, so take a minute, but it's not something that is not recommended. It is recommended to use, right? So it's not unrecommended. Now you can say, well, why did he use that? Because you'll see, when we talk about number two, you'll see, okay, that's why he decided to go, you know, down that double negative. Right? So not unrecommended water. وَهُوَ الْمَاءُ الْمُطْلَقُ, and that is just general, any type of water. Anything that you look at is just the natural water that has not been tainted with anything or with anyone. It's just water, then that's purifying. It's pure in itself, so if you touch it, you're not going to lose you're not going to have filth on you. It is capable of purifying you ritually, and it's not unrecommended to use, right? The examples of what are the examples of that? The seven types of water we just talked about. So the seven types of water that were at the beginning are examples of that. So why? How do we know that we can use? I'll use this as an example for like a dalil. How do we know you can use the water of the sea? Can someone give me a tissue so I can? If I write something, I can take it down. There's usually like tissue somewhere. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how do we know we can use the water of the sea? So rawa al khamsatu. So when I say rawa al khamsa, meaning the five narrated. The five are the four Sunan and Ahmad, Imam Ahmad. So when I say Rawa al-Khamsa, that means Abu Dawood, al-Nasa'i, al-Tirmidhi, Ibn Majah, and Imam Ahmad. So this is what the scholars of Hadith will use as Rawa al-Khamsa too, meaning the five sources narrate, and these are the five, the four people of the Sunan books, and then add to them Musnad al-Imam Ahmad. So these are the five sources that this Hadith was narrated. Rawa al-Khamsa, that the Prophet ﷺ said when he was asked by people who would sail into the Red Sea. He said, Ya Rasulullah, sometimes we're in the sea, and they of course didn't know back then when they first. So they were like, Ya Rasulullah, we only have so much pure water to drink. We make wudu in it, and then we're thirsty for the rest of the whole trip, and this is not working. So Ya Rasulullah, can we use the water of the sea? They thought they couldn't use the water of the sea just because it's salty. Like, they didn't ask the question, so they came up with they didn't know what to do. فَقَالَ صَلَّى اللَّهِ سَلَّمْ, yes, you can use it. And when they asked him, Ya Rasulullah, sometimes there's dead fish in it, there's, you know, sometimes you're making wudu and then a dead fish just floats by. You know, so what do I do now? Do I continue? Or do I go somewhere else and make wudu? So he said, alayhi salam, al-tahu al, yeah, he's talking about the sea. قال هو الحل والطهور sorry ماؤه الحل ميتته أو ميتته. هو means it is the sea, الطهور ماؤه, the one that's water is pure and purifying, الحل ميتته, the one that you can eat anything dead in it. So that, of course, that's a whole different issue when it comes to eating fish that are not properly, because that comes from this hadith. We'll come to that inshallah once we come to it in the text itself. But what we need from it is الطهور ماؤه, meaning it's the body of water that's capable of purifying you, when he talked about the sea, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam. So when you say, well, how, when you ask the question, what evidence did the scholars use to say that the water of the sea, specifically because it's salty, because it's different, there's something different between the water. When you look at the rest of the types of the water that talked about rain, hail, lake, river, snow, spring, well, all of it is pure water, you can drink it. But the sea is different, right? So there's a hadith that the Prophet ﷺ used that is narrated by a number of different backgrounds, and this is why we know that we can use ma'ul bahri. That makes sense? So how do we know that other water is usable? Right, so there's common sense, of course, that you should use every once in a while when it comes to understanding fiqh. And then at the same time,
Can you a little bit elaborate the maita?
So that you can eat whatever is dead in it. So if there's a dead fish, we're going to study this in a bit more detail, inshallah, later. But if there's a dead fish, you can pick it out of the sea, and if it has not rotten yet, then you can eat it. You don't have to actually slaughter it like you slaughter a cattle or a sheep. Like if you see a dead sheep, you can't just take a piece and barbecue it. It's not edible for you if you have not slaughtered it properly, if it just died from a disease or something. But when it comes into the sea, we're talking about fish specifically, and of course there's different opinions regarding how that all works, then you can eat from the sea. But that, again, that's something that inshallah yani we'll talk about later. But for us, for the purpose of this part of the text, huwa at-tahuru ma'u, means the water is the one that has water that is pure and capable of purifying. All right. Now, what evidence do we have that you can use any other water? وَأَنزَلْنَا مِنَ السَّمَاءِ right? مَاءً طَهُورًا. And we have descended from the sky, water that is purifying. So there's always evidence for something, but generally speaking, we know generally that water is purifying. So that's the first type of water. It's pure, capable of purifying, and it's not unrecommended. Now, the second one that you can use is وَهُوَ طَاهِرٌ مُطَاهِرٌ مَكْرُوهٌ. So it's pure, capable of purifying, but it's unrecommended. That's what the word makruh means, right? And so when you say the word makruh, it means it's unrecommended to use. Now if you use it, are you going to be, is there punishment that is attached to using it? Is there a punishment attached to using something makruh? No, but there is ajr attached to not using it. Right? So what is the water? وَهُوَ الْمَاءُ الْمُشَمَّسِ. And it is water that has been sitting in the sun for a very long time. Here's a classical example of how scholars thought back then and how we're supposed to, inshallah, take from that way of thought and learn and elaborate on. You see, the reason that they said that, so let's say if you've ever lived in a non-Canadian country, anywhere on the planet, then if you leave water open and under the sun for a while, then you come back and the water is extremely hot and there's a layer of something on top. I don't know what it is. Ask chemists, they'll tell you what's on top of it. I don't know. But so scholars, when they looked at that, they said that this is water that is pure. It can purify you, but we don't recommend you using it. So if you were to take, okay, why don't they recommend us? Why is it makruh? What is the reason? Because this is a ritual. The word unrecommended here is a religious term. It's not anything. It's a religious term. Like he's saying it's makruh, shara'an, not makruh, anything else. So why would it be religiously unrecommended to use? Because they thought at that time that using this water would cause baras, or would cause a certain skin disease. That's what they thought medically at the time. So doctors, if you were to speak to a doctor at that time and told him, I want to use water that is sitting in the sun for 4 hours during noon, he'll tell you, nah, don't do that. This could, you know, possibly cause you to have a skin disease. Yes?
Is there an amount associated with it? Because like the sea is under the sun.
Yeah, we'll come to that in a second. Just be patient. There's a few more verses, four more lines, and then we'll come to the amount issue. Yes?
Can you give an example of the third point? Like, would that be like using rose water or something?
Again, hold on for a second. We're not there yet. Just be patient. It's all coming in just work with me. Wait until we're finished waters, and then if there's any questions about water that's not clear, I'll answer it, inshallah, because we're coming to that. Now, why did they say that this is not something that is recommended? Because they believe that medically it was harmful. That is how scholars thought back then, and that's how we're supposed to continue to think today. Meaning, if they understood that something logically, rationally, within the different experimental sciences is saying that this is harmful for you physically, or medically as a person, then they would associate that with a religious ruling. Meaning they would use the word makruh because of the fact that medically this could cause you to have an illness. Now does hot water sitting in the sun, does it cause any skin disease? No, it doesn't. It doesn't cause anything at all. Like they just thought that at the time. So does that mean this is still makruh? No. That makes sense? And he's saying, this is fiqh. This is the human effort of coming up with rulings that serve. That makes sense? So there's no evidence here from the Prophet ﷺ or from the Quran in any point. And we don't really have any medical evidence that this is harmful. But this is how they think, that this is pure water, it can purify, but we heard that this can cause you to be sick, so we don't recommend you use it. Because Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala tells us that we're supposed to take care of ourselves. We're supposed to take care of our bodies. Yes.
So for our own purposes, can we say that anything that harms us should not be?
Yes, and that's exactly how fuqaha and the ulama al-usul, the people who understood not only fiqh and just memorized this stuff, but actually understood the origins of jurisprudence and how you come up with it, that's what they go by. They go by what is harmful. If something is harmful for you physically and mentally, then this is something that is going to have a religious ruling attached to it that will make it unrecommended or make it even haram. The same thing goes with something that is extremely needed. Meaning, if it's something that your body needs, or your height, your physicality, or your mental health needs it, then they will recommend that, and that will be a common part of Shara, and because that's how they understood Islam to work anyway. Yeah.
Just for my own purposes.
Yeah.
because this is a Pali text,
yeah,
we're talking about actual examples, not yeah, something like a ruling.
No, we're not. Yeah, we're not. So this is more like, day-to-day problems that people would go through, put all in one text. This is not the law, right? Law is usul al-fiqh. Right? Constitution is Quran and Sunnah and stuff like that. This is just the example data. This is just like watching Judge Judy, basically, just seeing how she goes by. Now, how she comes up with this stuff is the law, right? Now, I'm not going to discuss a lot of the law. I will give you examples of evidence and how they understood it. But generally speaking, it's just for you to see how things worked and then have an understanding of how you're supposed to practice properly. That's number two. Number three, طاهرٌ, right? غَيْرُ مُطَهِرٌ. So pure in itself, but not capable or not purifying. It can't purify you, but it's pure. وَهُوَ, number one, الْمَاءُ الْمُسْتَعْمَلُ. So water that is used before for wudu. So water that was used before for wudu. So an example for that, the hadith narrated by Imam Muslim, that the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, Jabir says, كُنْتُ مَرِيضًا فَجَاءَنِي رَسُولُ اللَّهِ صَلَّى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَسَلَّمَ. فَتَوَضَّأَ ثُمَّ صَبَّ عَلَيَّ وَضُوءَهُ. I mean, he came to me, I was very sick, and I was almost unconscious. What he did was, the Prophet, he made wudu, and then with the water that was left from his wudu, he poured it on my head. Right? And then Jabir felt better and got up. So what we take from the hadith, of course there's a lot of things you can take from this hadith, but what the fuqaha took from this hadith, is that this water that the Prophet ﷺ made wudu in, must not be najis. I mean, it's not filth. Right, because we're going to talk about najasa in a few minutes, which is something that if you touch is filth, you have to remove it if you're going to pray. It's something that may need you to ritually purify yourself. So if the water that he had left after his wudu was najis, he wouldn't have put it on Jabir, because it doesn't make sense that the Prophet is going to pour najis water on someone. So that tells us that you don't need that. It's not najis in itself. Now, what happens if it's why can't you purify yourself with it? So we've established through a hadith, I gave you an example of a hadith, established why it's not najis, I mean it's not filth. I understand. Did that make sense to you, or did I lose you there? Something? Now how do we establish, how did the Shafi'iyyah establish that this water cannot purify you? So there's another hadith by Imam Bukhari, where Abu Huraira says, قَالَ رَسُولُ اللَّهِ صَلَّى اللَّهِ عَلَيْهِ لَا يَغْتَسِلُ أَحَدُكُمْ فِي الْمَاءِ الدَّائِمِ وَهُوَ جُنُوبٌ. Do not take a shower in a small amount of water if you want to purify yourself. So if there's a little bit of water, right, don't take a shower, don't stand in the middle of it and wash yourself. Why? Because that water after that won't be purifying. So they said, يَا أَبُو هُرَيْرَ مَا نَصْنَعُ, what do you do? فَقَالَ تَغْرُفُونَ فَتَنَاوَلَهَا ثَلَاثًا. Meaning then you take out a bit and put on yourself. You don't sit inside the bin and then get up and expect this is not going to purify someone after you. It's going to be thrown out. It's not filth, it's not najis, but it can't purify you. So I'm just giving you examples of the hadith that existed and how they took from it, okay, that means that this is not filth, but this hadith tells us that it means that it can't purify you either, or else the Prophet ﷺ would not tell us that you shouldn't take a shower in a small amount of water, meaning standing in it, but rather by taking from it and then put it on yourself so that the actual origin of the water stays capable of purifying. So there's a bin of water, and I need to do ghusl, need to ghusl. I'm not supposed to sit in it and then get out, and then you sit in it. No, we take from it for ourselves so that the actual origin of the water in the bin will stay, or the majority of it will stay capable of purifying. Does that make sense, generally speaking? Or yes?
So what does it mean for something to be najis, exactly?
So what is...
For something to be najis.
Yeah, so something to... I mean, it has to carry something that is impure. Now, the najasat will come in a few seconds. So al-ayan al-mutanajjisa is the next chapter in the study, inshallah. So what are the types of ma' that is like that is pure but not purifying? He has two examples here. Al-ma'u mustamal, water that is used by someone else. So that water that is used is not najis, but you cannot use it for wudu. Of course, we don't have that because we just open a faucet. Like, we just opened up. This is more survival series type of stuff. So if you're in camping somewhere and you just have some water, then these things can become more relevant. But generally speaking, we don't need much of this right now. No?
A bath?
Yeah, so a bath. Yeah, so if you've taken a bath and the water in the bathtub, that water, you have to change it. The person behind you, like, it would be gross anyway, but still, they couldn't use it for wudu. Like, they would have to get rid of it and get something else. So the second type of water, وَالْمُتَغَيِّرُ بِمَا خَالَقَهُ مِنَ الطَّاهِرَاتِ. And water that is changed based on what other substances have caused on it, other pure substances has caused to it. So like the example of ma'al ward. So if you were to bring, there's water that has a nice perfume to it, like a scent. Now, is that water, can that still be used for wudu? If it still looks like water, right, and if it still functions like water, then yes, it can be. It has to change. Its structure has to change physically in a way that you can see for it no longer to be purifying. But if it's just, so let's say there's mud in it, or there's different. Sometimes if there's a lake or a swamp, then the water may have lily pads and different animals or insects in it, or just different plants or fungi. Yeah. So this is not khalatahu. This is not something that is being mixed with it. This is something that exists within it. The only time a lily pad would ruin water for wudu, if it was chopped up and then blended into the water, and the water now looks green, then you can't use it anymore. But if a lily pad is sitting in the water, you can make wudu. Are you understanding the difference between mixed with it and exists within it? So that the text here is saying that water that changed based on something that it was mixed with, not something that exists within it. So mud, and if you're making wudu and there's mud at the under it, that's fine, unless someone comes and just keeps on mixing it together until the water is no longer water. It's basically mud, or it doesn't look like water anymore, then you can't use that for wudu. Yes?
Does the change have to be like visual?
Yes, it has to be a visual change, something that you can actually see. Now, this is where science comes in, and this is where sometimes, well, we can detect now changes to things that they couldn't detect before. Like, we can see it, but just not with our eyes, with our microscopes and our... So no, we still stick to the visual, unless someone tells us like that it's harmful. It's like mushammas, right? So for them, when they were told it's harmful, because you can't see difference to the water when it's under the sun. You can't see difference, it's just maybe that little bit, that's not changing the water, it's still water. But they were told it's harmful, so if we're told that this water now is harmful, then you cannot use it for wudu. So if someone tells you this water has too much, the level of bacteria and is too high, then don't use that for wudu, meaning because that could actually harm you physically. Does that make sense, generally speaking? So there's two types of water. Now this is the water that you cannot use for wudu. Water that was used before you, someone took a shower in it or made wudu in it before you, or water that changed, its physical elements have changed, its structure changed, based on what it was mixed with from pure things. We're not talking about impure things. We're talking about a pure thing, like ma'alwar, like perfume, or maybe vinegar, or milk. As long as it's still water, as long as the amount that entered did not change the physical structure of it, so it's not white now, or it's not, it doesn't have a taste to it, then you're good to make wudu in because it's pure. But once it does, then you can't make wudu in it anymore. That's the number three. All right. Number four, the last, ma'un najis, so filthy water from a religious point of view, not from a hygiene one, impure. So now this is ma'un najis. وَهُوَ الَّذِي حَلَّتْ فِيهِ نَجَاسَةً. And it is the water where something pure came into it. So if I had a cup of water, and then a drop of urine came into it, because urine is an example of something that's impure. Now this cup of water is najis. I can't use this anymore. So I can't, obviously I won't drink it, but I cannot use it for wudu yani either. Right? So because there's najasa in it. Now, وَهُوَ دُونَ الْقُلَّتَيْنِ أَوْ كَانَ قُلَّتَيْنِ فَتَغَيَّرْ. Now here's where things become a bit more interesting. So what impure water is water that an impure substance came into it. If that water is under قُلَّتَيْن, وَهُوَ دُونَ الْقُلَّتَيْن, anything less than قُلَّتَيْن. What is قُلَّتَيْن? وَالْقُلَّتَانِ, if you look the explanation, وَالْقُلَّتَانُ 500 رِطْلٍ بَغْدَادِي تَقْرِيبًا فِي الْأَصْحِ. So it's around 500 Baghdadians rutl or gallons, the best opinion. Now that, of course, to us means nothing. Like, I hope it means nothing to you, because it means nothing to me. But it's around, yes? 200 liters. So we're talking about 200 liters. 200 liters. Anything less than 200 liters, and najasa comes into it. Any type of najasa. So urine, feces, yani anything that is najis, a dead animal, yani is inside a dead animal that bleeds, of course, because flies and insects don't count, but animals that are mammals, basically, and reptiles and birds, a dead animal in it, then this is najis. You cannot, not only can you not use it for wudu, if it comes on you, now you have najasa on you, you have to clean that off. Again, this is, of course, unless you're in a darura, and you're in such a situation where you have no choice, but generally speaking, that water is najis. What happens if it's more than 200 liters? So if it's more than 200 liters, then it can't carry najasa. The hadith that is narrated by Imam Muslim. Yes. Or maybe it's not. I don't want to. I'm not sure. But this is a very new hadith. إذا بلغ الماء القلتين لم يحمل الخبث. So if the water exceeds قلتين, it comes to the point of 200 liters, it does not carry najasa anymore, based on the fact, as long as it doesn't change its characteristics. As long as the characteristics don't change, it does not carry najasa. So again, if you have, let's say, 250 liter water, a bin, 250 liters, and then someone, I'll give you an example, a pool, an indoor pool. How many liters of water are there in an indoor pool? Way more than 200, right? I don't know exactly how much, but it's more than 200 liters, right? So a child gets into the water, and he does what a child does, and he walks out. Now, unless the water becomes yellow visually, or stinks, yani from an olfactory point of view, or tastes differently, then this water is still pure and purifying. You can make wudu in it. It's still pure and capable of purifying you. Why? Because it's over 200 liters, and it did not change characteristics based on the najasa that entered it. Understanding the idea? If it's less than 200 liters, if it touches najasa, it's najis now. It's impure, you have to get rid of it. You have to put it on for a tree or something. You can't use it anymore. If it's more than 200 liters, now it's based on whether the characteristics of it change or not. Understanding the difference here? It has to change characteristics. So the najasa that comes into it has to physically change the way it smells, tastes, or looks. So the color has to change, or the sense, you know, has to smell differently, or it has to taste differently. If none of these three things happen, meaning nothing changes, then you're good. This is still pure and purifying. Is that clear? So that's the point of qullatayn, the idea of two qulla. Al qulla being around 250 Baghdadian gallons altogether, so around 100 liters. So two qulla is 200 liters. So anything over 200 liters will not become impure unless its characteristics change. The way it smells, tastes, or looks. Less than that, all it takes is a drop. All it takes is something you can see. You have to be able to see it. If you can't see it, let's say that a fly was sitting on a pile of dog feces, and then the fly came and sat on your water, a small bin of water, less than 200 liters. Is that najis now? No, that's not najis now. في الفقه الشافعي, that's not najis because it's not something you can see. لا يدركه الطرف, meaning your eyes, you can't see anything. You know it was sitting there, but you have no idea. Like if any small part of najasa is there, you couldn't see it. I mean, you have to actually see the najasa entering, you have to see the amount of najasa. Yes?
Does it have to change the whole water? Like let's say in the pool?
Yeah. So you see a bit of urine, yeah, and then like a couple of seconds later, it's completely gone.
Yeah.
Now what about the rest of the water? Does it change its texture?
Yeah. Well, no.
So,
one end of the pool, you see the yellow.
Yeah. Come out. Now look at the whole pool. Is it yellow?
No.
Then you're good. All right? So that's the point of qullatayn. This is the point of understanding the concept of two qulla being over a certain amount, it doesn't carry impurity. إذا بلغ الماء القلتين لم يحمل الخبث. It doesn't carry impurities anymore, unless it changes. Does that answer the question you were asking? So unless it changes its characteristics, it's still tahir. Under 200 liters, immediately it becomes ghayr tahir, the moment a drop of any najasa comes into it. All right, so that covers the first paragraph, or the first part that talks about waters, different types of water. Now, faslun, the second the one after that. الأعيان المتنجسة وما يطهر منها. Yes?
So would chlorine make water?
No, because the characteristics of water is not changing.
But you can smell it.
Yeah, but chlorine is a cleaning factor. So when you're talking about something that actually cleans or makes it, it increases the hygiene, it doesn't change the qudr of tahara. So it actually serves a purpose, a hygienic purpose. And that's what most scholars are, I've given the fatwa for. Yeah?
Now, question. When the water changes characteristics, when do we classify it as najis or just tahara ghayr tahara?
No, there's no such thing when it comes to that. So when najasa, when something that is impure comes into water, only one of two things is going to happen. So a najasa enters water. All right, it enters the water. Now one of two things are going to happen. Only one of two things is going to happen. Either is going to stay tahir mutahir, pure purifying, or it's going to become impure. There's no middle ground here.
No, I'm not saying that you know it's najasa. I'm saying that you see a large body of water.
Yeah.
But if it kind of looks whitish, now you don't know if it's najasa or not.
So if you don't know, you don't assume. Yeah. So you don't assume najasa unless you know. Meaning you have to, because you have to actually know that it's najasa. Meaning the scent or the texture has to be telling you that this is najasa based on your understanding. But as long as it's changed characteristic and you don't know it's najasa, now it is pure, but it's not purifying. So you can't make wudu in it, which is the point of talking about. Basically, what we're looking for is, can you make wudu and can you take a shower and will it purify you or not? So no. If it's changed characteristics, it doesn't. If it's najasa, it's najis, and if it's not najasa, then it's just pure non-purifying. But if you see najasa falling into water, one of two things is going to happen. Either this water is more than 200 liters and hasn't changed its characteristics, so it's pure purifying, or it's less than 200 liters, or it's more than 200 liters and it's changed characteristics, in that case it's going to be najis. Did I confuse you enough? Yes.
So would it classify under not unrecommended or unrecommended if it does have najasa but less, more than 200 liters?
No, it's fine.
So it would be not unrecommended?
Yeah, it's not unrecommended. It's you use that, no problem at all. Because once it's over 200 liters, it does not carry khabath, so you're good to use. You don't have any reason not to use it. All right. Now, الأعيان المتنجسة وما يطهر منها. The different things that can carry najasa and how you purify and what you can purify from it. So, وجلود الميتة تطهر بالدباغ. And so, the different examples of filth is urine, is feces, and dead animals that have blood. So, we're not talking about insects or anything too small. So, if let's say you have a dead animal, like a dead dog or a dead dead cat. So its skin is najis, but it can be purified. تطهر من it can be purified بالدباغ. And دباغ is tanning. Now what exactly it is, I don't think it's used, I think it's used today still when they make fabrics out of animal skins. Not that I think they do that too much anymore. But what they do basically is they take the skin, they take off any substance that is meat or skin, or just leaving the wool or the coat from the outside. They take it all off and then they turn it over and put it in the sun for a long time enough so that there's nothing, there's no bacteria left on it. So basically killing any bacteria, and then it's scraped, whatever is left is scraped off and left in the sun again. So it's done a few times, and then after that point it's called dibagh madbugh. Now you can use that. You can put that in your home, you can wear it, you know, cover yourself at night, or of course again a lot of this stuff goes back to 1,000 years ago, so people don't use that as often. Yes? Comes what?
Green color.
So algae is not mixed in it. Algae is just something that's within the water, so it doesn't change anything. Unless, again, the algae is taking and it's mixed and, you know, blended into the water, so you can see, so it doesn't look like water anymore, you're good to make wudu in that. So we're talking about swamps and stuff like that.
Yeah,
so swamps are okay as long as the scent of the water has not changed and it still looks like water. Because there's a lot of things in that water as well. It's a lot different.
If
the texture changes, then yes, you can't use it anymore. But that's something that is a judgment you're going to have to make personally. I mean, you have to come to the water and look at it and see, has it changed its characteristics or is it still water? If it's still water, then you're good to use, inshallah. All right. So, to continue the explanation, وَجُلُودُ الْمَيْتَةِ تَطْهُرُ بِالْدِبَاغِ. And the skins of dead animals will be purified if tanned, if you use the process of tanning, right? إِلَّا جِلْدَ الْكَلْبِ وَالْخِنْزِيرِ. Except the skin of the dog and the pig. And of course, this is the opinion of the Jamhur. The Malikiyah have a different look at this. Right, so this is what the Jamhur say, meaning the prominent schools of thought think. The Malikiyah specifically as a school of thought sees things a bit differently. I'm not going to go into the detail of it today, inshallah, but just so you know that there's a different opinion regarding The fact that the skins of the dogs and pigs, do they, if we tan them, will they become tahir? So we say, so the jumhur say that no, they'll never be tahir. You can never use them. And the Maliki have a different opinion when tanning, because they have a different opinion of the body of both the khanzir and the body of the dog, and whether they're najis to begin with. Because in for the jumhur, the body of the pig and the dog are najis just by nature. They're just najis. And for Maliki, they don't see that. So that's a difference of opinion that's worthy of kind of talking about. وَمَا تَوَلَّدَ مِنْهُمَا أَوْ مِنْ أَحَدِهِمَا, meaning in all their descendants, so dogs and pigs and all the different types and species of dogs and pigs and everything that they, مَا تَوَلَّدَ مِنْهُمَا, means all the different descendants and species that come from them.
Cow and pig leather is used a lot, like mostly in shoes. And there is a lot of shoes.
Yeah, so again, when it comes to that, there's a difference of opinion. Like, there's a difference of opinion regarding, that's why I brought it up. So there's a difference of opinion when it comes to the usage of the skins of dogs and pigs. For the Jamhur, they see it to be najis, and the Maliki have a different opinion. Once we study, inshallah, a simple text in Maliki, I'll talk about why they did, and we'll go through their evidence and how they viewed things. And they have a very interesting look at it. Now, وَعَظْمُ الْمَيْتَةِ وَشَعْرُهَا najis. So, and the bone of a dead animal, of course, that is just, that was not properly slaughtered, of course. وَشَعْرُهَا, and it's and any hair or from the mane or that come, or wool that comes from it. Najis is also impure until it's, yani, it's tanned or used properly. إِلَّا الْآدَمِي, except the human being. So the human being is not najis during his life, nor is he najis after he dies. So there's no najasa for the human being, not, neither his hair, nor his bones, nor his skin, whether he's, you know, alive or passed away. All right, so that's just to kind of stop. Again, this is an introductory text. Now, the same three lines that we just read about tanning and about the skins of animals that died, right? It's three lines in this text, and it's around 13 pages in a bigger text. So 13 pages of just talking about that, of going into detail. So I understand that how it all works. So it's a build up. You start by understanding the basics, look at the different madhab and how they view things, and then you choose a madhab that you feel to work with you, you feel to agree with their opinions the most, and then you study it in a bit depth. Now what you're going to find, this is the funny part of the whole thing, is that you'll find in each madhab, basically in each madhab, there are all the other opinions of the other madhab within it. They're just not as prominent. Meaning, and that's why each school of thought is actually, is if you study it in depth, you end up taking everything. We'll wait for that, inshallah. Yeah. Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar.
Allahu Akbar.
Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah.
Ashhadu an la ilaha
illallah. Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah.
Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah.
أشهد أن محمد رسول الله.
أشهد أن محمد رسول
الله. أشهد أن محمد رسول الله.
أشهد أن محمد رسول الله.
حي على الصلاة.
لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله.
حي على الصلاة. حي على الفلاح.
لا حول ولا قوة إلا بالله.
حي على الفلاح.
لا حول ولا قوة إلا
بالله. الله أكبر، الله أكبر.
الله أكبر، الله أكبر.
لا إله إلا الله.
لا إله إلا الله، وصلى الله محمد وعلى صحبه أجمعين، وعلى الله التام والصلاة والقائمة على سيدنا محمد صلى الله عليه وسلم، وسيدة فضله والدرجة العتبة، بعث الله مقام محمد وعلى التوبة كفاة أجمعين. All right, the chapter after that. ما يحرم استعماله من الأواني وما يجوز. What you're allowed to use from when it comes to cups and plates and what is it called, cutlery? Yeah. So what you can use from it, what you can't use, what's haram to use and what's acceptable to use. Now, why is that even an issue? What they're saying here is ولا يجوز استعمال أواني الذهب والفضة. And you're not allowed. It's haram شرعاً. You're not allowed to use. Not permissible for you to use cups and plates and spoons and forks and knives that are made out of gold or made out of silver. right? Because it's two, because it's a matter of extravagance and it's a matter of takabbur. So this is why they, and there's a hadith of the Prophet, narrated by Imam Bukhari, لَا تَلْبِسُ الْحَرِيرَ وَلَا الدِّيبَاجِ. Do not wear pure silk or thick silk, pure thick or slim silk. وَلَا تَشْرَبُوا فِي آنِيَةِ الذَّهَبِ وَلَا تَأْكُلُوا فِي الْفِضَّةِ وَلَا تَأْكُلُوا مِنْهَا. And don't drink or eat in platters or plates or spoons or cups that are made out of gold and silver. فَإِنَّهَا لَهُمْ فِي الدُّنْيَا وَلَنَا فِي الْآخِرَةِ. It is for those who want to use it in dunya, and then you guys will get it in the akhirah. Yes.
Silk just for men?
Yeah, just for men. Yeah, just for men, not for everyone. Yeah, yes?
How is this related to Kitab al-Tahara?
Because it is seen as something that is impure, meaning you're using dhahab and it's not, so because you're drinking and you're eating with it, right? And you make wudu, and so it's seen as something to be impure. You shouldn't be using it, it's haram. So your wudu, of course, after that is going not to be accepted either, right? So it kind of connects to that in that manner, yeah.
Is it completely gold or is it like...
Okay, so like they said al-dabba, meaning if you have a... let's say you have a big plate and it's there's a hole in it, so it's becoming useless because you're putting soup in it or something. So back then they couldn't close those holes. Just like when you have a tooth, they use gold teeth and silver teeth because they just the nature, the physical nature of those substances seem to work better in fillings. So they would fill the hole with a with silver or with gold. And there's different opinions on with silver. The majority are, you're fine. You can close it with silver. Some are okay with you closing it with gold as long as it's not too big. It's not bigger than a coin. But if there's actual but that has to be purposeful. So anything that you're eating with, if it has silver or gold in it, you shouldn't be eating with it, even if it's just not pure silver or pure gold. But again, this is one school of thought's opinion. Right? So now, right now, you're thinking, hold on, there are different opinions out there. Right? So right, I'm teaching you one. So learn that one for yourself if you want to and follow that. And if you don't like it or you want to look for else, you can look for different opinions on that specific issue if you find yourself falling into a problem with it.
If there's design on the thing you're using,
it's still the same thing, so the same problem.
And for men, men are not allowed to wear anything that's gold.
Yeah, exactly. So it comes to the same. This is not talking about wearing here, it's just talking about the culture and eating or drinking. وَيَجُوزُ اسْتِعْمَالُ غَيْرِهِمَا مِنَ الْأَوَانِي. And you're allowed to use any other expensive culture. So you can use anything else, as long as it's not gold or silver. Why? Because the hadith that we have is specific on that, speaking on gold and silver. For the Shafi'iyya, they only see that gold and silver. Other madhahib have different opinions on that, saying that if it's higher, meaning if it's diamond, then if it's gold and silver is haram, then diamond should be, but the Shafi'iyya don't. Shafi'iyya say you can use diamond if you want. You can use, uranium if you want. You can do whatever you want. Just don't use gold or silver, because that's what the Prophet ﷺ specifically said. They didn't use any analogies. They didn't draw any analogies going upwards or downwards. Other madhahib did when it came to using kaltry. All right. After that, استعمال آلات السواك. The chapter after that, using the siwak, the tool of siwak, and of course it's called the tooth cleansing item. Now, والسواك مستحب في كل حال, and it is recommended to use siwak in every situation of your life. Yes.
Just going back to.
Go back. Yes.
Was diamond known at the time of
certain types were, not maybe what we have today. So there you go. Now you're starting to think like a scholar. See, that's how scholars think. So did he leave it out purposefully or did he not leave it out purposefully? So some people say yes, some people say don't. When they don't, they differ in their... So this is how people think. Are you understanding how it works? This is how it works. So they think, did he or did he not? Some people say, no, he didn't. Or he meant it like that. Or some people, Shafi'i said he purposefully let them out. He's just talking gold and silver. And that's why they said you can use anything else.
But there was a diamond at that time, right?
There are certain types of diamond, right? I don't think any of the diamonds at the time were ever used as kultri ever, because diamonds are very hard to turn. Like only recently could you actually take a diamond and turn it into something that is a tool. Back then it's almost impossible. They didn't have the tools back then to do that, but they could take gold and silver and then put it under a certain heat and then it became liquid and they can turn it into anything. So again, it's a long understanding how it works. So this is how the difference of opinions comes from. There's different ways to look at things. There's different possibilities. So there's always going to be different rulings out there. Jazakallah khair. All right. So it's mustahab. It's recommended to use siwak in every situation. إلا بعد الزوالي, لِلصَّائِمْ except after noon for someone who is fasting. If you are fasting after Zawal, then you shouldn't use it. But Imam al-Nawawi, within the Fiqh Shafi'i, said that it's okay even then. So this is an example. There's like 17 different places in this book where the Abu Shuja' al-Asfahani, the author of this text, will go against the prominent position of a Shafi'iyya sometimes with what he'll say, which is normal because Shafi'i madhab evolved after he died for many years, so they changed certain positions. So this is one of them, where in Shafi'iyya it's okay to use siwak even when you're fasting after midday. But he, in this text, he's saying that it's makruh to use it after, it's not haram, but it's makruh, it's unrecommended for you to use it after noon, after 12 o'clock or 1 o'clock noon, when you're fasting. وَهُوَ فِي ثَلَاثَةِ مَوَاضِعَ أَشَدُّ اسْتِحْبَابًا. And there are three situations where it's extremely recommended for you to use a siwak. Number one, عند تغير الفم من أزم وغيره. So when the scent of your breath changes from long periods of sleep or long periods of not talking. So when you wake up, of course, the breath of death is inside of you. If you, yeah, all you have to blow in someone's face and they will, inshallah, move on to the next world, yeah, or wish that they did before that happened to them. So that's one of the most extremely recommended times for you to use siwak is when the scent of your breath changes after long periods of not talking or long periods of sleep. Yes?
Is it also a substituted toothbrush for siwak?
Very good. So I'm going to come to that in a second. I just want to finish this and I'll come talk about that as an example. Very good. Jazakallah khair. Number two, عند القيام من النوم, when you get up from sleep. So that's number two. Number one, if you're not talking for a very long time, so your breath changes, or you just wake up from sleep. وعند القيام إلى الصلاة, when you go up for prayer. Now, what is the substitute for siwak today? We use toothpaste and toothbrush. Now, that doesn't mean that we don't use siwak anymore. If you have a siwak and you come off, it's very hard to come by siwak that's actually good siwak that doesn't crumble into your mouth when you're using it and actually destroy your gum and your bleeding before prayer. Because when you're bleeding before prayer, then you can't pray at all. So it turns into a more big of a problem. So to find good siwak is not as easy. But if you do, then it's still mustahab. It's still something recommended to use before. The Prophet ﷺ says in Hadith Bukhari Muslim, لَوْلَا أَنَ أَشُقَّ عَلَى أُمَّتِي أمرتهم بالسواك مع كل أو مع كل صلاة. If it wasn't the fact that I didn't want to make things hard for my ummah, I would make sure that they purified their mouths with siwak before every prayer. So what we take from this is the concept. The concept is make sure that you don't have horrible breath when you're talking to people or when you're talking to God, the Rabbna subhanahu wa ta'ala. Make sure that you take time and purify. Now we have toothbrush today. Make sure before you leave house, you take that with you. Buy mints. If you don't know what mints are, go find out what a mint is. Especially if you're a teenager and you're talking to me during the day, please buy a mint and pop one in so that I actually enjoy having a conversation with you. So make sure mints is an example of what you can substitute siwak for. It never means that siwak is not going to be mustahab. It's always going to be recommended, but there are other things that come in and serve the same purpose like siwak. We'll just explain the beginning of the next chapter and then we'll go for prayer. Subhanallah, we don't have much time to finish much, but we'll finish page 17. Faslun, so the next chapter. فُرُوضُ الْوُضُوءِ وَسُنَنُهُ, the obligatory actions of wudu, the fard, and then the recommended actions of wudu. وَفُرُوضُ الْوُضُوءِ سِتَّةُ أَشْيَاءُ. For the Shafi'iyya, there are six things that are obligatory for wudu. So what you're going to learn from this is how to make wudu properly as far as the Shafi'iyya are concerned. Again, now you know how to make wudu properly based on the opinion of over 25,000 scholars. Like back then, this is like around 600 scholars. 25,000 scholars who studied Islamic texts and Islamic evidence, and this is what they think is the obligatory actions of wudu. So you'll make wudu and you can feel very comfortable that you're doing it in the proper manner. Right? But there are other opinions, like the other madhab have different opinions on what the furud of wudu are. We'll maybe talk about a few of the differences once we go through them in depth. But the six things, number one, an-niyyatu 'inda ghasl al-wajhi. So you have to have the intention of wudu before you actually start with the first movement or the first item of purification, which is the face. For Shafi'i, the first thing you start with is going to be the face. So you have to have made the intention of wudu before you wash your face. If you make the intention of wudu after you wash your face, then it doesn't count for the Shafi'i, you have to go back again. Right? So it's important to have the intention. Now if you didn't think about wudu, you had a very dirty face, hands, feet and head and arms, and you just washed them all, and you didn't make the niyyah for wudu for the shafi'iyah, this is unacceptable. Meaning this wudu that you made has to be repeated because you didn't have the niyyah. Now that's not the same case for all madhahib, and it's not the same case, it's not the only opinion that exists within each madhab. There are a difference of opinions regarding is niyyah needed for wudu. So there is a difference of opinion, there is a debate regarding that issue. Meaning, because, yes? So when you can't remember if you made the intention or not, especially for acts of for rituals, you should do it again with the intention, because you want to make sure that your action is going to be accepted, right? But it's very difficult for you not to remember, did I make the intention or not? You can kind of get mixed up on a lot of things, but I'm not sure how you could get mixed up whether I made the intention to do something. I mean, did you know what you were doing, or did you not know what you were doing when you did it? Which is basically what an intention is.
Why else would you be making wudu?
Exactly.
Why else would you be?
There wouldn't be really.
Why else would you go to just do those things in that specific?
Exactly, unless they're very dirty by chance.
Yeah.
Right. So
this three times, and that three times, and this.
Exactly. Then you're doing wudu, right? Okay. Jazakumullah khair. So we'll stop here at number page 17. We will continue inshallah next Thursday. Jazakumullah khair. Subhanakallah bihamdik. Shadu an la ilaha illa anta astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammadin wa ala alihi wa sahbihi ajma'in. Barakallahu fikum.